From the printed page to the TV set on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. Linda Cook has made a media transfer. We'll ask her what that's like on Scribble. Well, you're kind of a changeable person anyway, aren't you?
Try to be. Flexible. I call it flexible.
Well, you know, in this day and age, Linda, flexibility is the key, isn't it?
It is. And as I grow older, I find that the people who are inflexible seem to be older than I am, regardless of their physical age.
Yeah. Nicely put.
Yeah, it's... You have to be able to adjust to a rapidly changing world, I must say. But all those years you spent as a reporter,
I'm still a reporter.
Well, you're still a reporter, but the medium is different, right?
Correct. There are two facets of it now. But the transition began probably 20 years ago when this thing called the internet came along, mm-hmm. right? I remember this so well when the internet came along and became not a household word, but something people mentioned. I remember thinking, this whole world is going to change then.
Yeah.
How can we have that much information? How can that be? And this phone that no one can see me waving around is a supercomputer that has all the knowledge I want to access and more in my pocket. And sometimes I still marvel at that.
I worry about it all the time. Are you a computer or a phone person, Rebecca?
I love this. You said marvel and you said worry about the phone.
Well, that's the kind of guy I am.
Well, no, it's I'm not someone drawn to technology, and probably we were just talking about the difference between composing something with a pen and paper versus a keyboard. And I'm old school, I guess. I always kept journals and wrote longhand. And it does take longer. And the world has sped up. And so, you know, it makes sense what Linda was saying about, I don't have time to write things down by hand. I guess I worry and I marvel about the phone. I don't really like being accessible to anyone, students or otherwise, who want to call me at any point. So I kind of forget my phone. But when I had little kids, I needed to have one for car accidents on the road or some, you know, needed to have one. But I'm not enamored with it the way my kids are, the way everybody.
You're a keyboard person, aren't you, Linda?
Yes. And I learned typing.
Oh,
not
that's
keyboarding.
A mystery.
Yeah.
Not keyboarding, but typing. And I remember the class. I remember, in fact, I've been in touch with my teacher from high school. And I've thanked her many times for this, because what she taught me was one of the most valuable skills I'll have throughout my life.
Yeah.
And I never realized it. Back in those days, we sat at typewriters.
Yeah, yeah.
If you were lucky, you were assigned one of the typewriters that had an automatic return.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm taking you both back, and there are people out there going, what is she talking about? What is she talking? What is this? What language is this? But the automatic return, I thought, was the greatest thing since sliced bread, because it saved you time. You would reach your little pinky finger over,
uh-huh.
and you didn't have to take the carriage handle and throw the carriage, remember? Yep. I know you do. I can tell by the look on your face. Don does, too.
I see. You're lazy people, that's all.
Well, you know, but weren't we efficient with that automatic return?
You know, what I remember is the correct type, how exciting that was when you didn't have to put a piece of white, whatever that was, kind of film almost.
Yes,
you'd slide in and retype, that the typewriter would just do that again with a key, and that just seemed like a miracle.
It was a miracle.
Well, the great miracle was when I got a computer. Everybody was getting a computer, so I got one, and I installed it upstairs, you know, kind of put it in a hutch, like a little rabbit, and I left it alone. And then I was doing my column always on the IBM correcting Selectric, batting it away, and then delivering it to the newspaper. And then one night, the correcting Selectric died. It just died. I couldn't do anything. So I ran upstairs, thought, how do you work this thing? And I turned on the computer and started working, and I discovered, hey, you can correct words. You can shift paragraphs around.
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
And a few years later, I learned to send it.
You can send it. Exactly. You don't have to carry it somewhere.
Yeah. I should mention, we're talking to Linda Cook. Linda Cook, who for a long time was a reporter at the Quad City Times. She also was a teacher. She's had a very interesting life, and now she's a reporter for television for Channel 4.
Yes. And I'm what they call, I'm a hybrid. I don't know that they've had anyone in the newsroom quite like me, because I walk in both what we call the digital world and the newsroom. And what I like about this is the challenge of thinking about what I'm writing, not only for our website, which I have to plug, it's ourquadcities.com. Mm-hmm. And anybody can access it. We have an app, too. And you can get updates. If you have the app on your phone, then you get the updates of what I've written, which simple.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The concept is simple. It took me a little while to adjust to that idea, the immediacy of it. But then when I did, I thought, oh, this translates into television, because if I talk to our producers, then that news can make it on almost as it's breaking.
Sure.
And I've seen that happen. And that, to me, is amazing, too.
Yeah.
But then suddenly you're on TV.
I was yesterday, yes. I was. And that is a whole different way of writing and thinking about what you're saying in a visual way.
Yeah.
Whereas back at the Quad City Times, when I started, before computers, before the internet, one photo did it.
Yeah.
One good photo, one good story. Mm-hmm. Now everything and every medium is fragmented into pieces that become a whole, whether it's digital, visual. Think about radio, what we're doing now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? This is one of the first podcasts I ever listened to before people talked about podcasts.
Podcasts, yeah.
Yeah. Is this a podcast?
Yes.
I didn't even know
you didn't
that.
Know that you were.
I taught my mentor something. I taught my mentor something. I have my job here is done. You guys go ahead. You two go ahead and talk.
No, wait. You can't blame me. I'm not your mentor.
Yes, you are. Like it or not.
See, we were just talking about that before too. He was describing how, you weren't a successful friend and conversationalist because you do things over the air, and I kept saying, that's just another way to do it. You don't have to sit down and talk with somebody one-on-one.
Right.
That's one way.
That's right.
You have this other way.
Well, you know, the radio station, since I stopped being general manager, has changed in ways that I don't comprehend or even know about.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And this program is being podcast, huh?
It is truly a podcast.
Well,
it is something you listen to,
you
add don't
it to
watch,
your resume.
and they're archived, so people can go back and listen to them.
Well, that's a threat. I mean,
that's wonderful.
The thing I've always liked about being a talker rather than a writer is you can always say, I don't think I said that.
But once it's
not
in
on
print,
scribble,
they'll come back and
check scribble is forever.
Yeah.
And when you put it in writing, people can show it to you.
Right.
Unless you're somebody like Trump. You
exactly.
know, you just deny reality altogether. But, yeah, that's the thing about writing. It can come back to haunt you. And that was one of my misgivings when I started doing a column. And I look back at those early columns and I think, how stilted. You know, I was not writing easily. And it took me years to start to write the way I talk. And then it seemed to go pretty well.
That's pretty common, I think, as a teacher, anyone who's taught students about writing. You know, they begin very stilted because they've got a sense of what it's supposed to be before they're actually making it. I think about this just with papers, you know, that they you kind of have to tell them this is a process. It's a process each time you write a paper, but it's going to be a process all through your college career if you go on writing after that. And yeah, you get better at it, you hope.
Well, you know, you're a perceptive teacher, and that's important. I remember I took a course, at my age I've told all my stories, but I took a course in cosmology. There were five questions: what is time, space, place, stuff like that, being. And at the start, Father Ed O'Connor was teaching it. He said, you'll be asked five questions at the end of the course. What is time? What is space? So time stopped me cold. I could not wrap my head around time. And I read about definitions of time and so on. And when the test came, boy, I wrote about time. And Ed O'Connor was a really perceptive guy. He gave me an A and he handed it back. He says, I have a feeling you're not comfortable with time. I said, you're right. I don't get it.
I can write about it, but I don't get
I can write words about it, but what is it?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. And the definition he used, it's the before-afterness of change.
Oh, that's lovely. Say that again, please.
The before-afterness of change. You take the beginning of a change and the end of a change and make a noun out of it, and that's time. And I thought, that sounds nice, but I don't get it.
Well, you just mentioned change, and I'm thinking about how you introduced what Linda did to me in making this move from doing print to being on television. How is there a difference in speed? Is there a difference in editing? Is there a difference, you know, in how you think about? You just sort of touched on that a little
yes,
bit ago.
Yes, definitely. When I pitch a story now, people don't say, why should we do that story? They say, and what visuals do we have? So I'm not used to that.
Sure, yeah.
Over all those years, I mean, I might have a visual. But what's fun is now, after watching all these movies, thousands of them over the years as a film critic, I get to do little teeny documentaries all the time.
Yeah.
Every day I get to do some little documentary. Now, let's see, a couple of weeks ago, that documentary was Keto, the Rhino at the Zoo. And I went there and met we weren't properly introduced, but I met Keto, and I thought this was such a phenomenally wonderful event for the Niobe Zoo, and I'm a fan of Niobe Zoo and of all animals. And the as I had my and it's an iPhone 12, which takes amazing video, I happened to walk up to the enclosure, and this large, gargantuan animal looked at me, and he lumbered up to me and looked right at me. And
this is
so
a rhino?
The new rhino at Niobe Zoo, they had a campaign that lasted some months for to obtain one of these rare animals. And he's part of what is hoped to be a breeding initiative at the zoo. So my colleague, Ryan, and I, Ryan knows how to, they always say he knows how to work the big camera, which is a huge camera that I don't even know if I could carry. I probably could, but, you know, with the tripod and what we think of as the quintessential camera for television. So as he was interviewing this little boy who had been part of this campaign, it was really cute and very earnest. This animal lumbered toward me. I was able to capture that on video. It's still on my phone. Well, I'll show you when we're done here.
Yes.
And at that moment, then I tweeted that. I sent that out to the world. Uh-huh. So the people who follow me in this social medium through our television station / website, I mean, we are a news medium, but it's really more than one. They were able to see what this animal looked like long before they could see him on television.
Sure.
Before they saw the still photos, I was able to do that. So this idea of breaking news is a lot more immediate than it used to be.
But that means you're thinking about news all the time.
I do.
That's, won't that rot your brain?
I don't know. We'll see. So far, so good, right? Isn't there an old saw about a man falling several stories, and as he goes through down each story, he yells, "So far,
so good." So, I don't know that. That's great.
That was that great comedian saying, "I intend to live forever." So far, so good.
So good.
Well, the thing, as I listen to you, probably it's a temperamental thing, but I think I would be so anxious all the time about missing something, about whether, I think I, with writing, I have to retreat to solitude and a kind of calm. And the fact of something like you just described being immediate, how do you know that it's, I don't know if good enough is the right word, but how do you know that that's the thing to send out right then?
You don't.
You just do it.
Yeah.
And people react. People will send you an email or a call or a direct message or a personal message through some device and say, "Oh, you're such and such," or, "Oh, you're at this fire. I saw the flames from this fire." There's a lot of give and take, personal give and take now that I didn't have as much of at the newspaper that I do now.
But the problem I have with all of this is that it isn't edited the way newspaper stories are.
Well, my stories for the website are.
They are?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because there's so much stuff on the internet that is pure garbage. I'm fascinated by the way Russia doesn't worry about its military might anymore, because with its computers, it can achieve its aims around the country. They have a building there, a huge building, with 3 8-hour shifts of people coming in, pretending to be Americans, and tweeting over to this country, and taking both sides of any question, and just to stir up the divisions in our society, because they believe democracies are inherently weak and fallible, and if we can just deepen that divide, they'll wipe each other out or finally go to a reasonable autocracy of some kind. And they are succeeding all over the world.
Terrifying.
It is terrifying, yeah. They learn how to be a person in Omaha, for example, that what's in Omaha, what it's like, how to speak like an American, to know idioms and so on, and then just introduce themselves normally, and then later on they can put in a little opinion that helps drive a wedge. And with all that information on the internet, anyone who can get on the internet can find out anything about you they want, so they know what'll work and what won't. That's the kind of world we live in, and I find it very uneasy.
You're part of it right
I'm
now.
I'm part of it. I know.
As you speak out into
it right
the
now.
Ether.
Exactly.
I hope we're not damaging any minds today.
Oh, that's the other question I have for you. So as you get responses when you send things out, do you find that you mainly get supportive reactions, or do you have to deal with people complaining and nitpicking, and do you get that as well? And how do you navigate that?
You try to have an earnest conversation, try to explain why I wrote what I wrote or why I was there. Why did I show a picture of this person being arrested, being led away in handcuffs, whose and I had a grandmother call me and say, he didn't do it. You know, and I, why did you write about my grandson? And I said, because he is accused of a felony.
Yeah.
You may be right. He may be innocent. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But at that moment, he was being led away in handcuffs.
Yeah. But you know, that's a corollary of what happens in newspapers. People will put out a sensational charge, which makes headlines, and then later on you find out, oh, that's garbage, and so the retraction is somewhere back on page 8. And the impact of the false is stronger headline than the impact of the correction.
That's interesting. What I can do is write a story about the lesser charge. Now, in fact, I did this last week. A woman, I won't go into the story right now, but it pleaded to lesser charges in what could have been, I will say, a heinous crime against another person. Now she's pleaded guilty. She pleaded innocent before, but the charges are lesser.
Well, that happens a lot in the legal system.
People are appalled, Don.
Yeah.
And of course it does. It happens millions of times a day. But when it is something like this, people are just, they're appalled. They're surprised and they're appalled.
Yeah.
I will follow this particular story to the end. And there's another component of this story coming along in the courts. It's either Monday or Tuesday. I need to check my calendar. Mm-hmm. And I will be there. Now, I may not be there in person. I may be there in a Zoom courtroom.
Okay.
And I've grown used to that now. This is something new. Then this doesn't have anything to do with the transition. It has to do with the transition of society to the pandemic.
Right.
But I am now checking in to courtrooms to watch people make appearances on my screen.
I was talking to Barb Ikus not long ago, and she was all a flutter because they're going back to the office. She's been working from home for so long, and I think in many places, working from home is going to be the new norm. And what will that do to office space, valuable office space in downtown areas, if you don't fill them with workers, if they're working from home? Because it's easier, more convenient, you don't have to get dressed.
Yeah.
The pandemic is going to change, has changed, and is going to continue to change our lives because it's not over by a long shot.
No.
Right.
No,
but...
And that's what we, you know, we keep wanting to rush. This is it. We're free. No, not quite. Mm-hmm. Almost not quite.
Not quite.
Better wait and see. And but folks are a little impatient. And I guess you can't blame them, but that is a way to keep the whole thing going.
Well, I was fortunate in that I was able to work from home for such a long, long time. But before, long before anyone talked about the pandemic, I was a supervisor. I was a program chair at Kaplan University for the online branch. So for years, I did work from home.
So you were,
and the people who reported to me were all over the country. I was used to that. I was used to not seeing the people with whom I worked. I was used to that give and take over the phone or a message of some kind. So I adapted very quickly to it.
But now you talk about 8-hour shifts. Do you work an 8-hour shift and are you off the rest of the time or are you always on?
Yes, sometimes and no.
Thanks, that clarifies that.
Let's try to be clear.
Yeah.
I have worked many long hours because if there is breaking news, I'm going to chase that breaking news. Whether it's, unfortunately, hearing that the Figgy was shot up in the downtown. I was there at that scene. And I went home and cried. And the Figgy, to me, is a sacred place.
Yeah.
And to hear this, that this had happened. I happened to be listening to the scanner. It was very early in the morning, and I was doing something else, and I live very close to that area. I got the other reporter up with the big camera. I said, "You need to get here now," and so I went downtown and talked to a woman who'd heard the shots and said, well, my compadre is on his way. Would you talk to him? Of course, she said. So by the time he got there, everything was ready.
Yeah.
But before I went to bed, there was a story on our website, and the tweets had been sent out about this. So then we did follow up.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Was that within your 8-hour shift?
No, but then the next day or the next week, I just took time off. Uh-huh. I adjusted the hours. So yeah, I work about 40 hours a week, uh-huh. give or take.
Well, you know, with so much automation and so much immediacy in the world, I know one country is reducing to a four-day work week. And I wonder if that'll catch on.
I did that one time.
You did?
When I worked at a university, when I worked at St. Ambrose, I worked 4 10-hour days. I loved it. I absolutely loved it because you'd have that 3-day space, and you could travel. You could get on a plane and go somewhere and come back very comfortably.
Right.
Yeah, I loved it.
You have, in the work world, and especially in communication, you have done it all, haven't you?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what's next.
Yeah.
And there will be something that's next that we can't even consider as I gaze once more at this miracle, this supercomputer that I carry around with me. What is next? And I think the way we absorb our entertainment is changing so fast that theaters, production companies, television studios, they can't wrap their heads around it.
But in this frenzy of information, how in the heck do you ever learn to contemplate, to stop and think, how does this make sense? Is this really true? You know, the quiet space is where your mind really deepens. And we are surrounded, we're bombarded with information all the time. And we have to trust that what we're watching or listening to is true. And I promise you, we're not lying here today.
But we're bombarding people right now
with
this information.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they'll turn off the radio and think, let me think about that.
I hope so.
Well, and we're probably close to needing to wrap things up. But this is all making me think about an essay that was written probably 25 years ago by Billy Collins, poet laureate, it was called The Companionship of a Poem. But he was talking then, 20 some years ago, about why he thought poetry was important, because it forced that kind of contemplation.
Yeah, well, anything that gets you to think is good. It's also dangerous.
Good and dangerous go together.
Good and, well, what the heck? Well, anyway, you are well in it now, and you're having fun?
Oh, absolutely. I work with people who have just their diplomas, or the signature on the diploma is still wet, right? I work with people who are very, very young, very, very new, and people who've been in the business for more than 20 years. So I have a wonderful gamut of people surrounding me.
Yeah.
And to work in this digital team is really, really fun. The fellow that heads it used to work at the Quad City Times.
We have run the gamut right now, so the theme is creeping in and we're creeping out. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening. I'm Don Mouton with Rebecca Weed. We'll be back next week for another Scribble.